You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to the Ready Room, show number 51, White Makeup and Motherboards Go! I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the TNG remastered theatrical schedule, a Paramount park in Spain, Star Trek's Best Doctor, Spock Days 2012, and some movie news and rumors. Then in the feature, we're joined by Brian Finifter of Down in Front, Drew Stewart of Cinetropolis, and Mike Rittenhouse of 5-Year Mission to discuss Star Trek First Contact. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week?
Chris, I'm doing great. I spent all weekend working on my upcoming short film shoot, which I'm very excited for. So the whole weekend went by as a complete blur. What about you? How are you doing?
Pretty much the same for me. Pretty much a blur, but hanging in there, and the weather's getting kind of warm and toasty, so
nice.
It's been a good and busy week overall. We had a lot of great feedback from our 50th show last week, our 1-year anniversary show. And one thing we got there, Greg, before we jump into news today, I just wanted to play for you. We got a message from Charlene, who you know, she's a little bit biased, of course, because she is Trek FM's Voyager editor, but she's also on the Delta Quadrant podcast. So let me play for you real quick here the message from Charlene.
Hey there, Chris and Greg. This is Charlene, your Voyager series editor and resident sex and relationships expert for Trek FM. I just wanted to congratulate you guys on your 50th show. It was awesome. And not just because you had one of my Delta Quadrant co-hosts on board as a guest. I just thought it was a lot of fun. You guys did an awesome job talking Emissary. And here's to 50 more, and more and more and more and more. I appreciate all the times that you've had me on as a guest. We've had a lot of fun, and I've had a thoroughly wonderful time taking you guys off topic and divulging into weird scenarios dealing with whales, alternate Star Trek IV synopses, things with lizards, time travel, you name it. We've been covering it, and I hope there's more opportunities in the future to do that. So anyway, guys, thanks again. Here's to more podcasts, and keep up the awesome work.
All right. Well, that was very nice from Charlene. Now, you noticed there, Greg, she got that lizard bit in there.
Yeah.
Again, you know, it's all about mating with her, I guess. So
it really is. It's, you know, I don't think if we have her, me, and Michael on at the same time that there's any way we could talk about anything other than mating pretty much all shows. So. But it's good. It's good to have her around. She's one of my favorite guests. And I Charlene, I do really appreciate you leaving us that message. It feels good to have people who have been with us so long and want to hear more shows yet to come.
And who are not tired of our rejected Star Trek IV plots either.
Yes.
So that's great. All right. So, Charlene, thanks a lot for the message. We really appreciate it. All right, Greg. So why don't we just jump on into news this week? Because we got a lot of stuff here
on
the slate this week. And we'll try to not have a 2-hour-plus show. We've been really failing at that recently.
I know.
We were like 205 or something last time. So, and we were talking about Emissary, too, somehow.
I know. Well, it was a double episode, so.
Yeah, that's our excuse.
Yeah, there
that's
it is.
It. Yeah. Well, first up, Greg, TNG information. And now last week we went, or at least I went on my rant about the TNG pricing.
Right.
So we have a little bit of an update on that. And also, perhaps more importantly, we have the actual schedule for these theatrical showings of episodes from season one that are, you know, tied into the release of the Blu-ray.
Right. Now, I believe last week we knew that they had the screenings. They're going to happen on July 23rd. But now we do know that tickets are going on sale this Friday. If you're listening when this is recorded, this Friday, June 8th, you can go to fathomevents.com or go to StarTrek.com and there'll be a link to it. And actually get your tickets. And I'd recommend, you know, talking to your friends, find a theater in your area, go as a group. It's going to be an awful lot of fun. I've already talked with a couple people here in Seattle that I'm going to be going with. So if you want to come along, just, you know, tweet me and let me know that you want to come along and we'll add you to the group.
And I really wish I could join you guys too. I'm going to really miss out on these, and there's no way that they're going to show them in Japan. So I'm pretty much out of luck here, but it's quite extensive. Now, we're not going to go through here on the show the listing of all the theaters because there are... How many are there, Greg? I mean, there's at least 100. Are there more than 100?
They're showing this at over 600 theaters.
600,
so,
okay.
Yeah. So this would take a little bit longer than reading through the 47 captains took last week.
That's right, which was quite lengthy.
It was. So, yeah, we won't read all of them this time.
I'm glad you didn't know who S. LaForge was, yes. So you could stop. Otherwise, you would have kept going and going. I'm sure our listeners were very thankful for that as well.
I'm
although
sure
I did get some messages about how much people loved your announcer voice.
Glad to hear it. It might return in a future show.
Yeah, but about these theaters, I know, anyway, that TrekNews.net has a very nicely laid out extensive listing of the theaters, if you want to hop over there and see if it's showing near you. Now, again, the episodes that they're showing are Where No One Has Gone Before and Data Lore.
Right.
And as I read comments online about these showings, I have to say I think people are really just... really missing the point of why they're showing these episodes in particular and why they're even doing this in the first place.
Why aren't they showing Chain of Command?
Well, the one I get, I read a lot is, why aren't they showing The Best of Both Worlds? Like, because it's not in season one.
Right. Slim pickings, guys, really. I mean, they had to pick from what they had, you know. Yeah. And these are ones, you know, with good special effects. And that's kind of what we were saying last week is they're going to show off the ones that are going to look really cool on the big screen, the ones they've done a lot of work to. So they're not going to show a bottle show, you know, on the big screen. They're just not going to.
And as you pointed out too, Greg, I mean, with Data Lore, the new crystalline entity will be in that episode. And there's little doubt in my mind that that's why they're showing that particular episode.
Yeah.
So there is a reason for why they are... showing the ones that they're showing. And in terms of the other complaint I hear a lot about is that, well, what's the point of seeing this? Because the resolution's going to be low. You know, they can't show the Blu-ray resolution on the screen. And it's marketing, everyone. This is a promotional thing to drum up interest in the release of the remastered TNG. So,
yeah. And I don't know. Do people not remember? Do people not remember when they did this for the original series? I mean, I went. I certainly saw. I don't actually remember at this point what episodes. I think they showed the Menagerie the night I went. It was fantastic. I mean, sure, they're just showing the Blu-ray up on the big, or the HD DVD, when it was 2008 or something. They're showing that up on the big screen, but, you know, it was fun. You know, you're there with a bunch of other Trekkies. There's people dressing up. How often do you get to see Star Trek in the theater? And this is next gen. I mean, these are next gen episodes. It's sort of these are going to be like the fans at this point, the people like Dork Trek and that they're coming back to the show and realizing next gen's really cool, not just people in it for the nostalgia. These are going to be really great events.
Well, that's the point. You're getting together with other fans. Yeah, I mean, that's why people go stand in line at the Apple store to get an iPhone.
Right.
I mean, they don't have to stand in line, but it's fun to stand around with other Apple people and talk about the phones. So it's same with the Star Trek here. It's just a fun chance to go out and see it. So
definitely.
I think it'll be great. Now, there's one other update here about the pricing of the Blu-rays. Again, I went on my rant last week. I'm still out of luck here because there has been no movement on the pricing in Japan, which is still crazy. But in the U.S., Amazon lowered the price to $78.86, and Walmart has matched that price. So instead of $91, Americans will be able to get their hands on these for $78.86, which it's still a little bit higher than what I think it should be, but it's definitely a move in the right direction, and I think that it's reasonable enough.
Yeah.
At $78, it's reasonable enough that you could pick them up. So I don't know if this is a permanent change or it's kind of like a temporary pre-order kind of thing that they're doing. Yeah. We'll just have to see. I also read that CBS is saying that the retail price is $118, which
I don't understand because I see it listed as $129.99 by everyone, but
yeah, well,
whatever.
We'll see when it actually comes out. I was hoping for more like $69.99, but you know, if it's $78, no, that's $9. I'm not gonna quibble over that. They're doing better. These prices make a little bit more sense. Yeah. I still probably won't be buying copies for my family and friends for Christmas, but this is a much more reasonable, much more in line with what I was hoping to spend.
Yeah, it's definitely a move in the right direction. And I also just wanted to mention, because I realized when I listened back to the show last week, I went on about the yen thing, and I know a lot of people don't really know what the yen is worth. The yen is actually more valuable than the dollar. The yen has a value about 25% higher than the dollar.
Right.
So when I talk about those prices, I'm not being screwed over because the yen isn't valuable. It's like they're really charging an arm and a leg here.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's like they're still pricing it for what the yen used to be. Although
yes.
Even then, this would be a little ridiculous. But yeah, with where the yen's at now, I don't know what
insane.
They're thinking.
Yeah, it's so. Crazy. All right, well, I'm not going to rant about that today. But if you want to check this out, you can go, like Greg said, to fathomevents.com or go over to startrek.com to keep an eye on tickets. Treknews.net also has great listings of the theaters. And you can find out when TNG Remastered is coming to a theater near you.
Oh, and I also wanted to mention, they're not just showing the episodes. There's also going to be a behind-the-scenes featurette.
Oh, that's right.
That's going to be a little bit showing how they did the remastering, as well as a portion of A Measure of a Man, apparently. I don't know right. why. But so a little bit extra more than just the episodes.
Yeah, which, by the way, is not a documentary about Riker. So, all right, let's go on to the next story here, Craig. What do we have up next?
Well, we have news about a Paramount park in Spain.
Yeah, this one somehow slipped by me until this news came out here this week that they do have this Paramount park that they're building in Murcia. It's actually Alhama de Murcia, Spain. Mm-hmm. And it's the Paramount Theme Park and Lifestyle Center. So apparently you can ride rides. You can also get aromatherapy and also possibly, you know, information on, you know, planning your parenting future. I don't know. It's a lifestyle center of some sort, I hear here.
Understand, it's Europe. And Europeans see the world a little differently than you or I may. So they're looking for something different from their theme, something different in their theme parks than we are. So this makes perfect sense to me. Aromatherapy, massages, Dabo. These are things that Europeans appreciate that maybe Americans don't.
I can just see the attraction now where you get your aromatherapy from Klingons.
Right.
And then you get to do the bonding ceremony.
Right. Nice.
This, they have, it's like at Disneyland, they have all these different people who play Mickey Mouse or Donald Duck, you know, around the park. They have like all these different kids that play Jeremy Astor, and they're all standing in there, and you do the bonding ceremony, and it'll kind of become a thing that you want to make sure you have your photo taken with every Jeremy Astor at the park.
Nice.
So every summer you have to plan a trip.
And just like in the show, after you bond with your Jeremy Astor, you promptly forget about him for the rest of your life.
That's right. What'd you do last summer? Well, I can't remember.
Yeah.
There were some candles. I don't know.
So let's see. So Paramount Park Murcia apparently has, what is it, 5 sections. And one of them is like the Star Trek section. And there's going to be like a plaza with big like Federation emblems and stuff, and a ride where it simulates going to warp speed. Stuff is, it sounds interesting. I mean, there's a Paramount park. Well, it used to be owned by Paramount where I grew up, and they had nothing Star Trek related. I think there was like a Top Gun ride and a Wayne's World ride, and those were the only Paramount properties.
What is a Wayne's World ride? You sit on a sofa and
it was called the Hurler. I don't know. It was a wooden ride. It wasn't very good. I don't know. But they're showing clips from Wayne's World 2. I was like, why don't you have a Star Trek ride? You own the Star Trek. I mean, you're Star Trek. Like, and this was in the heyday of Star Trek, too. This is when DS9 and Voyager were on the air and there were next-gen movies in the theater. I mean, why don't you have a First Contact ride where you fight the Borg, or an Insurrection ride where you, I don't know, run around in an invisibility suit?
Oh man,
not a very exciting movie.
Yeah. That's I guess maybe there was some exclusivity deal with the experience in Las Vegas or something
possible.
Like that.
But they're actually doing it here. Like, so if you're a big Star Trek fan in Spain, this is going to be really great. And then there's other Paramount properties that you're going to be able to experience as well. So sounds really great. Now, is it like the one in Jordan that's running on a perpetual motion machine?
I'm not sure. I actually think this one, there's going to be a warp core in the middle of the park. And
there you go.
You know, I mean, some special interest groups may have a problem with the idea of powering an entire theme park with antimatter. you know, they weren't real thrilled with that whole CERN Large Hadron Collider right. thing. Yeah. And so this is actually going to be above ground right in the middle of the park. But I don't know. Now, I will say that if the Star Trek area turns out to look anything like the artist renderings that they have shown, it's going to be really cool. And I would love to be able to visit this park at some point in the future.
Looks pretty astonishing. The only thing I could imagine better than this is if they would actually build Starfleet Academy in San Francisco, just like we see it in the JJ movie. That would be, I would go there every year for the rest of my life.
You know, it could be like the ultimate end game in the battle between science fiction franchises, because as you know, Starfleet Academy, the whole Starfleet grounds is built on the Presidio. Mm-hmm. And right now, George Lucas built his crawler machine,
right,
Jawa thingy building in the Presidio.
Right.
So they would actually have to destroy the Star Wars structure in order to build Starfleet Academy. So in the end, and this isn't speculation, we mm-hmm. know because we've watched
we've
it on
it.
The screen.
It's there.
Yeah. Star Trek wins in the end.
Nice. Yeah, well, I mean, yes. I'm looking forward to that happening. I don't know how they're going to blow up the sand crawler, but that's going to be quite impressive.
Oh, yeah, sand crawler. That's what it's called. Jawa thingy.
Right.
But if you want to know more about this park, you can go to Paramount Park Murcia. That's MURCIA.com. And find out all kind of information. I think there's a video of the park, not just the Star Trek elements, but the whole thing as well. And you can see artist renderings and so forth. And it's going to be really cool. And they're planning to open it in 2015. So just a few years from now.
Yeah, just in time for it to be like another 5 years before the next Star Trek movie.
That's right, yeah. The next Star Trek 3, the exploration for Spock, will be coming out in 2020.
Yes. Very exciting. Very exciting.
All right. Well, moving on, Greg, one thing that's coming up, this kind of snuck up on me as well. In the city of Vulcan in Alberta, Canada, every summer, they have a very special event called Spock Days. And it's already time for Spock Days. It's going to be held June 8th through 10th in Vulcan.
Now, is this different from what happens to Spock once every 7 years?
Well, I think at Spock Days, every 7 years at Spock Days, it becomes this like carnal event where all these people who usually don't come the previous 6 years, they all
right.
descend on Vulcan to fulfill this urge of mating. And I know if Catherine is listening to this show, she's going to be sending me a message.
Probably.
Chris, what are you talking about? We don't do mating at Spock Days.
So
it's
so
not
what,
a carnal event.
It's not the red hour?
It's not the red hour. That's right. No. Spock Days is a very family-friendly event that takes place every summer in Vulcan, Alberta, Canada.
Yes, there's barbecues, parades, fireworks. There's like a holodeck, I understand. It actually sounds quite fun. And if you're looking for a time to go to Vulcan, the Spock Days would be like a concentrated time to go and not just see the sights, but see a bunch of Star Trek themed events that are going on there as well.
Yeah, in addition to all the other Star Trek elements that they have there year round. And also, you remember we talked about those bus shelters that they were having in Toronto, I think it was?
Mm-hmm.
Was it Toronto? Earlier this year, where you could take your photo, you know, you can make yourself kind of transported
right.
out.
Might have been the one in Calgary, I think.
It was Calgary. That's right.
Yeah. So those are going to be here as well?
Yeah, those, cool. After that Expo was over, they moved them, I believe, permanently to Vulcan.
Oh,
so
nice.
You'll be able to see those as well. There's going to be Q&A sessions, autographs, meet and greets, photos, and they're going to have Walter Koenig. Connor Trinneer is going to be there. Who
These
has
are two of the most famous Vulcans in Star Trek history.
That's right. And then Crystal Allen, who I believe played one of the Orion slave girls on Enterprise, is going to be there. Garrett Wong and Arlene Martel will be there. So
cool.
That's confirmed right now. Anyway, well, I guess the event is coming up in a week. So I don't know if anyone else will be there or not, but it's just going to be a great thing. If you want to know a little bit more about Vulcan in general and Spock Days, if go to trek.fm/MS. I want to say it is, but if you go to trek.fm/MS, Catherine Pooley actually joined me on MatterStream quite a while back, and we talked about all the things in Vulcan, and we talked about Spock Days as well, so you can find out even more. And if you want to know more about this, you can go to vulcantourism.com. They have a new website up, great new website, and you can go there, and right on the front page, there's a big column, Spock Days 2012, and you can find out all the information you need about the event, travel, how to get to Vulcan, and everything. So I hope you can go and enjoy Spock Days in Canada.
Very cool. So let's see. Also, I believe I texted you this link as soon as I saw it, because this is right down our alley, and it was a poll put up at StarTrek.com. Which doctor would you most want to treat you in an emergency? I think we've actually talked about this a few times on the show, haven't we?
I think so. Now, I think it depends on what kind of emergency we're talking about. Now, if the question was, which doctor with a pink ribbon in her hair would you like to treat you during a...
Let's just say that I have some insomnia that needs to be cured.
That's right. I don't think that's the question that StarTrek.com was asking in this poll, however. I think this is probably a medical emergency.
Probably, okay.
Where it might be a matter of life or death for you from a medical perspective. And so who won the poll here, Greg?
And actually, very surprisingly to me, the quote, the doctor, not Doctor Who, guys, the doctor, the medical EMH from Voyager, actually won the poll with 29% of respondents saying they would want him treating them in an emergency. Now, I'm assuming this is either you're already there in sick bay or he has his mobile emitter and he can come to you. But I guess that makes sense because he's got all of Starfleet medical knowledge right there in his head. He doesn't have to look it up in a book.
I think that's the point, that if someone were going to come up with a solution, I think that the EMH would be my best bet for surviving.
Right.
I mean, who else would have thought to put holographic lungs inside Neelix?
Exactly. And then that's the sort of genius work that he did. Now, yes, his bedside manner left a little bit. I think he might be up there with Pulaski. I don't know. That's a good question. Who has worse bedside manner, the doctor or Pulaski? The thing with the doctor is, as long as you're there in the first few seasons, Kes is there too. So that makes up for a lot of the doctor's failings.
Yeah, and he became better in terms of his bedside manner as it went along.
Yeah.
Again, you know, reading some of the comments that came up, a lot of people, I think, were making their selection based on their... Someone mentioned that the EMH had the most growth as a character, and he had a lot of humorous moments. And someone else said they have a crush on the holodoc. And I think the question is really in terms of their medical ability, not the writing of the character and how they grew. But number two is McCoy, followed by Crusher. So apparently a lot of people have a death wish.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they didn't understand the question because they're injured too much, and maybe Crusher hasn't helped them yet.
Maybe so. Then Bashir, then Phlox, and then Pulaski with 2% of the vote. So no love for the doctor.
Now I think Phlox was so low, not because he's not a good doctor, but just because he has such unorthodox methods. I mean,
I think so.
Yes, I wouldn't, if you've got to save me by putting an eel like inside of me, I understand, but maybe I'd prefer a different method to be figured out. He always seemed to have some eel or bat or slug that he was trying to put inside of your body. And I'm not big on that.
Trip's like, Doc, I got a headache this morning. What can you do for me? And he's like, well, come in here. I'm going to let this bat suck on your neck for a while.
Exactly. Right. That'll clear it right up. But yes, and then Pulaski. Pulaski just, the thing is, Pulaski's very competent as a doctor.
Yes.
She's the only doctor that doesn't make rampant mistakes all the time. So I'd want her over Beverly. I'd want her over Bashir. I'd want her over Phlox. Bones, I would probably rank it the doctor and then Bones and then Pulaski, honestly, if I'm looking at my top three.
Yeah, I might agree with you if it were for survival rate. Now, let me ask you,
exactly.
Greg. Now, if Pulaski put a pink ribbon in her hair, would that do anything for you?
That wouldn't change. That wouldn't change anything at all. Just a hat and feet. That's all that's left of me. A spot on the sidewalk, a mark on the street. I'm just a hat and feet. I'm just a hat and nice.
All right, Greg. Well, it's quite possible that in some scenes in the next JJ movie, we might see someone who's merely a spot on the sidewalk and just a hat and feet from some of the photos that have been leaked out.
Yeah, apparently, let's see, what's her name? Anjini Azhar, who's playing the daughter of Noel Clark and Nanzian Contractor in the film. So it's this young actress. She basically had her picture taken with all of the actors from the show and then JJ, probably at Glamour as well. And then these were posted online publicly somewhere on her Twitter feed or something.
I think on Facebook.
On Facebook, yeah. And they basically, they got out. As things, everything posted to the internet will get out, people. That's what happens. It's basically, this is a rule if you're in a relationship as well. Like, never let a picture be taken that you don't plan on everyone in the world seeing at some point. And
exactly.
And perhaps JJ should take note of that as well. Or I guess especially who should take note of that is Simon Pegg and Anton Yelchin.
They should, because when you look at these photos, you know, most of the photos, it's like her and Zoe, her and Chris Pine, like you said, her in the Glamour, her and Zachary Quinto's stunt mm-hmm. double.
Right.
I don't know. But they're just in, you know, street clothes, and they're just kind of standing around. They're all fine. But then there's this one of her with Peg and Yelchin in full costume. Costumes we've never seen before.
Never seen before.
And they're both grinning away.
Grinning. And Yelchin made sure to grab his hat, which is this brand new prop. It's this big, gaudy brown hat with this symbol on it. Made sure to have that on in the picture.
Yes.
I'm surprised they didn't grab their little whiteboard and start writing what the title of the film is, scribbling in like some plot details.
Yeah, in the background, there's like a first draft theatrical poster on the wall.
Right.
Khan's Revenge.
He's like holding up a model of the Botany Bay.
Or he's there. She's in the foreground and Peg's got his head tilted sideways, and Yelchin is dangling a little SETI eel with tweezers over his ear and looking at the camera with a big grin.
And the key is they're grinning the whole time. It's like,
and Peg's got his mouth open like, ah, the eel's going to get in my ear.
So the point is, I guess, that we now have this ridiculous picture showing these new uniforms. And okay, all right, so we don't know where these uniforms are going to be used. When you break it down, they're not that different from some of the uniforms we saw, like during Kirk's graduation, when he graduated from cadet to captain. They all were sort of wearing these more militaristic looking uniforms.
Well, in that scene too, there are some officers towards the front who are holding hats They're not wearing the hats, but they're actually holding the hats. The hats look a little bit different than these, but they are there. So,
yeah.
I don't know. I thought all kinds of things when I saw these. I mean, one of the first things that came to my mind was the eugenics wars and Khan, because if you went back to that time period, you would have most likely soldiers on Earth who were wearing, because these look like, I mean, these actually look a lot like World War II uniforms as well. So then I thought, time travel. So
But then they have the Starfleet emblem on the hat and on and on the chest. So
So I don't think that's what it is. I think you know, in Star Trek 3, there were some cases where people were wearing hats as well in the space dock. They didn't look like these hats, but you haven't seen people wearing hats in Star Trek very often.
Yeah. I mean, there was a guy, when was it? It was when they were all preparing to leave to go to the fleet that was about to get blown up by Nero. And the sort of pencil pusher who was keeping Kirk from going on the Enterprise, he had a little hat on. It wasn't this big, gaudy hat, but he had a little cap. So it's something we've seen now and again. So it'll be interesting to see when is his uniform actually used. But I'm assuming for most of the film, we're going to see those bright color uniforms.
I think so, yeah.
But maybe, you know, maybe what I'm thinking is when you're on the starship, you wear your command colors. And then when you leave, you go to some event, you're at a promotion. This is sort of everyone looks the same uniform because they don't need to have the different command colors and it would look like a rainbow effect. Yeah. So maybe that's just what they're trying to do, have a distinction between when you're serving on a ship and when you're, you know, on Earth at some event.
Like at the end of the movie, after they defeat Khan, when they're back at Starfleet Academy and they're having this kind of celebration and a ceremony to honor the Enterprise crew, you know, for defeating Khan. Yes. They may all be wearing these. It looks kind of like a formal. It's a formal uniform, I think. So,
I mean,
I don't think it's any time travel element or anything like that.
And I guess by the 24th century, the quote dress uniform is more of a, what would you say? I mean, it's more of a formalized version of the ship uniform, but maybe, you know, this is earlier in history. Perhaps the dress uniform is more militaristic looking. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see that after they defeat Khan and they're all wearing these.
Yeah, probably so. I saw a photo on Trek Movie. Someone highlighted a scene from the cage inside Captain Pike's quarters where he's sitting in his quarters and he's got like this old television like my great-grandparents used to have, the big, you know, wooden box. And on top of it, there actually is a hat that looks very, very similar these hats in his quarters in the cage. So there is some kind of like very obscure precedent for this existing in Starfleet in this time period. So it could be just a cool little thing, you know, that Lindelof and Orsi and them picked up on as fans and just kind of brought it forward into the movies.
Yeah, and I don't know how likely that is. You know, maybe Bob Orci saw a picture from the cage and said he wanted to stick this in there. But yeah, no, it's an interesting little thing, and we'll just see how much it's actually used. I really want to see that first publicity still where they're wearing the actual colors. I want to see that command yellow. I want to see it again, because we only really saw Kirk in that command yellow for the very, very, very end of the film.
Yeah, and I know what you're hoping for, too, is you're hoping that they're going to replace Dr. McCoy's uniform with the Deep Space Nine teal science uniforms, right?
Oh, God. When did it turn into teal?
It's
when did this happen?
Like early DS9, it kind of
and
morphed into this teal color, yeah.
It even bleeds back into Next Gen, because what's the episode where Picard meets Q? Tapestry. Yeah. Maybe it's Q. Anyway, and he comes back and he's on the ship and he's a science officer or something. And it's a teal uniform. It's a TNG uniform, but it's teal. It's not even blue.
It's not quite as blue as before, and, right? But in Tapestry, it's not as teal as it becomes. DS9 and Voyager and even Enterprise, it's really, really a teal color at that point.
It's very teal. And even in the films, I was noticing today that Troy and Crusher, they have extremely teal sort of under things. I hate the teal. I hate it so much. I like the blue.
Because you reach a point where Crusher, yeah, the blue, her blue lab coat and her uniform are like very different. Please, you sent me that iMessage the other day. You said,
"What was it?"
You said, "Beverly finally stopped wearing her blue coat all over the ship."
Well, she started just wearing it in sick bay, but it used to be that she'd wear it to the staff meetings.
I know, everywhere, right?
She'd wear it on away missions.
Doing yoga with Troy with her blue lab coat on, right?
So. I mean, it's like from the Big Lebowski. You know, he wears his whatever that is, his you know, what is the word? His shower, you know, he wears that robe.
Oh,
he wears his
like
robe everywhere.
Yeah.
He wears his bathrobe everywhere. Yeah. Yes, and that's what Crusher did.
All right.
I do think, yeah, we should move on, but I miss those blue uniforms. And I think part of the problem is when you washed that blue, it got lighter and lighter and lighter, and they never found a way to fix it, so they switched to the teal. It still bugs me. Anyway.
Well, I like them both, but
hopefully we'll have bright blue uniforms in the next Star Trek film.
Probably. We'll probably have some like all-color cheer product placement or something as well.
I hope so.
All right. Well, let's we have just a couple more movie items here, and then we'll wrap up news and get into our feature. So quickly, apparently they have interconnected Enterprise sets now, which is interesting news to come out after they have completed the shooting of the film.
Yeah, exactly. I guess Damon Lindelof is talking to the press now because his film Prometheus just came out in the UK. And he was talking about how on the first film, they were having to build, you know, the bridge on one stage and then sickbay on another stage because they were on Paramount stages. But now they've moved into the Sony sound stages and they have much, much bigger room to work with. So they've actually built more of a model of the Enterprise. So you can go from one set through a corridor into another set, which I'm sure JJ's going to love that because it's more naturalistic. He doesn't have to do quite as much cutting. He can really show off the sets, and that's always really fun. I don't know if you've seen the film Serenity, which is basically the follow-up to Firefly, but the opening shot of the film, basically, is the entire ship because they built the top level on one set, the bottom level on another set. So they did sort of a whip pan cut in the middle, but the whole thing, you see the entire ship from stern to tail, or whatever those words are. And it's really impressive. So I hope they do some stuff like that in this new Star Trek film.
Yeah, it'll be exciting to see. I'm glad they were able to expand the sets as well.
Yeah.
So what else do we have up? Oh, a couple of bits of Cumberbatch news here.
Yes.
Apparently he's blindingly brilliant. Actually, well, he is blindingly brilliant. I think Peg may have said that, but also Cumberbatch himself says that the sequel is blindingly brilliant. Now,
yes.
Is this a reference to JJ's lens flares? I mean, has he like really poured it on?
I think
this
it's
one?
Very possible.
Yeah.
The film is also shakingly astonishing. Yes. And blindingly brilliant. Yeah, I don't know quite what this refers to. I he's just looking for things to say, I'm sure. But I you know, he went, he did the whole film. He knows the script. He knows better than I do whether or not the film's going to be good.
Yeah.
So that's
I think he's just
Benedict Cumberbatch says it's good.
Yeah, he's looking for ways to deflect the questions about Khan. I mean, someone again they asked him about this. He was speaking at the BAFTAs and I guess on the red carpet, and someone asked him about Khan, and he says there is all sorts of speculation about all sorts of characters. It would be kind of spoiling it for everyone if I clarified anything. So I am going to leave it with a smile.
What did these reporters think? I mean, they're asking like ridiculous questions like, how did playing Sherlock prepare you for playing Khan? It's like, he's not going to answer that question, guys.
Exactly.
He's just not. And they're doing the same thing with JJ. Yeah. Like, how did directing the kids in Super 8 prepare you for directing Benedict Cumberbatch as Khan Noonien Singh in the new Star Trek?
Right.
He's not going to, that's not something he's prepared to lay out for you
or
guys.
His questions like, you know, so JJ, how would you describe Cumberbatch's portrayal of Khan in your next movie? Right? Very direct questions.
Like
he's going to slip up and go, well, you know, I think I made the right choice of casting Cumberbatch as Khan. I mean, as the villain in my next movie.
Right.
As not Khan.
Yeah. Okay. They should be sneaky and just ask, you know, how muscular is the chest piece of the person you hired to play the Star Trek villain? And if JJ says, you know, it was appropriately muscular looking, maybe you can infer that perhaps this is Khan.
Right. Yeah. It's not like a Wesley Crusher.
Is Benedict Cumberbatch
time traveled?
Yeah. Is Benedict Cumberbatch able to lift Anton Yelchin with one arm? You know, ask him questions like that.
Probably so, I think.
He's a small guy.
All right. Well, so related to this, I guess, is everyone's favorite rumor monger, Simon Pegg, apparently has been added again. Is that what I understand from
the
story? He's
fed up. He's fed up, Chris. He keeps reading the internet. He's there on TrekMovie.com every day. It makes him very, very angry. Because everyone's assuming at this point that it's Khan. And he says, what does he say? He says, it's not Khan.
It's not Khan.
I think that's the quote, right? It's not Khan.
But you have to read between the lines here, okay? Who's the host of Dork Trek? Not Captain Picard, right?
Yes, exactly.
So when he says it's not Khan, he doesn't mean it's not Khan. It's capital N, not hyphen Khan.
Yes.
It's not Khan.
It's
That's
not
what
Khan.
He's saying.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. And I'm looking forward to Captain Not Chris Pine teaming up with Captain Not Patrick Stewart to defeat Not Khan.
That's right. I should have, said the host of Dork Trek is not Patrick Stewart.
Yes.
It's just the voice. It sounds so much like Patrick Stewart and Captain Picard.
It's perfect. They must have hired like a professional impersonator,
I think so.
Someone who charges, you know, hundreds and hundreds of dollars an hour. Because it's just, and they get them on for every show too. You know, every time they want to say staff meeting, you know, that's not just one of them doing it. That's that impersonator that they've hired,
and it sounds just like him. And it's not just staff meeting; it's all sorts of lines just throughout every episode of Dork Trek. Picard is talking all the time, and I'm amazed that they're able to actually get him there for every show, but it sounds exactly like him.
Dock the saucer section, buddy.
Exactly. All right. Well, I don't know. Peg says it's not Khan. That's a myth. Everyone's saying it is, but it's not. So we'll see.
Yeah. So this means something or it doesn't mean anything, and we'll just have to wait a couple more months to find out.
Exactly. The first big screen outing for The Next Generation was more of a bridge between the original series and TNG, but then 2 years later, we got First Contact, which was the first true outing for Picard and his crew, and today we're going to talk about First Contact, and to help us do that, of course, Greg's here, and with us once again, we have friend of the show, Brian Finifter from Down in Front. Hi, Brian.
Hi, guys.
And we also have Mike Rittenhouse from 5-Year Mission. Hey, Mike.
Hello.
And we have first-time guest on the Ready Room, Drew Stewart of Cinetropolis. Hi, Drew. How are you?
Hello. Doing good. Thank you.
All right. Great, guys. We have a full house.
All these video screens are starting to feel like, it feels like the Brady Bunch or something. We should start singing and looking at each other.
We should do that. Yeah. Let me resize my window here.
Oh, yeah. Wrong direction.
This is perfect.
Oh, perfect. Yes. Yeah, we just decided to assimilate as many people as possible today to talk about First Contact.
Right.
Why don't we kick off? Why don't we start with our first-time guest, Drew? And Drew, tell us maybe just your first impressions of First Contact when it came out.
Well, when Greg asked me to talk about First Contact, I went to Netflix and I searched Star Trek First Contact and I watched it. It wasn't anything like I remember. I mean, it was really short. It focused on these weird-looking aliens. Lilith from Cheers showed up and seduced Riker for no reason. I mean, it was really good. It just didn't have the Borg or time travel, and I was really confused.
I think you saw the alternate cut there. Yeah, the one with Space Lilith, which was... I think, Drew, you're supposed to watch the movie First Contact, not the episode First Contact.
Oh,
right.
Oh. Well, I watched that too, so that's okay.
Good. Okay. We're okay there.
What is it with them reusing? I guess Nemesis, that was also the title of a show. I guess Insurrection, they never used in Generations, but it just seemed like,
I mean, they reused Where No One Has Gone Before, Where No Man Has Gone Before. I mean, they're just...
There you go.
What isn't there an episode title that they've reused in almost every single isn't it Emissary? Haven't they used Emissary in there almost every single?
Yes. Yeah. There was the Emissary, and then there was Emissary.
Yeah.
And then there's Harbinger, which is, I think, an episode, a book, a game, and one other thing. So they find a word they like, and they just keep banging.
In fact, it was used so much. Most of our listeners don't know, but you know, Greg's full name is actually Greg Harbinger, and he shortened it because he felt that it had just been overused, and he didn't want it.
Star Trek Greg Harbinger.
All right. Well, Mike, how about you and your first experience with First Contact?
I actually saw it on opening night at the theater.
Nice.
Went with some friends, and it was pretty awesome. We had seen Generations in the theater too, and that movie was pretty good, but First Contact, I mean, it completely blew me away, and it to this day is still my favorite Star Trek movie.
Of all the movies?
Of all of them. Wow. Of all 10 movies.
All right.
That's quite a statement.
All right.
Or 11, however many there are.
10 and a half.
Now, Brian, I'm sure that in our many discussions that you've joined us for on the Ready Room, we've had to have talked about this movie here and there a number of times. But what are your thoughts on First Contact?
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Well, I have to tell just a little bit of a story from my... I actually don't really remember actually seeing it, but I do remember... I think it would have been middle school. It would have been eighth grade, I think, when it came out. And I couldn't actually see its opening night because I was part of some organization at school that was throwing a dance, you know, organizing a dance, school dance, and it happened to time at it happened to fall on the same day as the opening night of First Contact. And the only really distinctly vivid memory I have is of standing at the dance with one of my best friends at the time, my friend Giovanna. Who was also a huge Star Trek fan, and I think like my first girlfriend, I think technically, or something along those lines. And both of us just being like standing there at this dance, just like just knowing that this new Star Trek movie existed and it was across town and it was there, but we weren't.
Phasers are being fired. Yeah, time is being changed.
Borg are being fought, and we're not there. but I do remember. I do remember being. Even at a young age of being an indiscriminate moviegoer at the time, being less than thrilled with Generations, even when it came out, even just still being a kid, but seeing First Contact being like, oh, okay, awesome. So they needed a movie to get traction. Okay. But now we have, you know, now the Next Generation has their own, they're totally on their own, and they've gotten the ball rolling, and we're going to get, you know, six awesome Next Generation movies that are all going to be just like this, and it's going to be great.
Yeah.
And that never really happened, but that was a good feeling to have that night, at the very least. So that was my introduction to First Contact when it first came out.
Yeah, it did feel that way at first. It was the start of what was going to be. Yeah.
Yeah, it really carried that sense of, okay, the torch has been fully passed, and now... they have this momentum behind them that will carry through for at least equal to what came before, you know, to the original series that came before the original series crew, if not more. And sadly, that didn't happen so much.
Yeah. I think it kind of felt like Generations could be the more thoughtful, talky sort of Star Trek, and then First Contact was the more action-oriented Star Trek, and they could sort of go between the two, because Next Gen sort of had that, where not every episode is talky and not every episode has explosions. And it's capable of that. So, yeah, it was sort of both sides. But now looking back at, you know, the four TNG films, I think I like Generations more than I did at the time. And then First Contact, yeah, I'm starting to see its flaws. Where I used to say, yes, this is my favorite, at least of the next-gen films. Now I'm a little wavering on it.
It is my favorite of the Next Generation films, including Generations. I've never been a big fan of Generations, but it's just a pretty low bar. I mean, it's First Contact is a good, it's a decent film, but it's the company it keeps is lower than that, unfortunately. So over the years, First Contact has gone down a notch or two. If you watch the Red Letter Media review,
I watched that today.
The Plinkett, the Plinkett's. Huh. You know, he's famous for his reviews of the prequels. He did this big thing, disassembling the Phantom Menace, and into the other two prequels as well. But he's also done them for all of the Next Generation films, and that for me was the most, something I thought was good, or at least I thought more was better than it was, and then his deconstruction was like, oh no, you bring up a lot of good points, actually, unfortunately, and it did definitely change my perspective on it.
I learned a lot from that. I've never really been a big TNG fan, so the movies is really how I know the characters, and then in the Red Letter Media reviews, he compares and contrasts the way they act in the movies with the way they act in the show, and it's like, that maybe that's why I never really got into the show, because they never acted like they did in the movies. Because the movies are always like, let's blow stuff up. And this in the show is like, let's sit down and talk about this.
Well, I mean, I did like, I mean, the movie's very, bang, bang, bang. There's the first, I don't know what it is, like 5 minutes of the film. I mean, they have a staff meeting in there, but the staff meeting is like, each person has like one line, and it's just like, we're not going to fight. Why not? We're not.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on. I feel like if it were the show, we'd have a couple extra scenes of like exposition. Let's see if we can drag this out. Let's have a long conversation about why we're not going. Just, there'd be a lot more pages of that. Whereas the movie is just, let's get us to the battle as quickly as physically possible.
Yeah. Yeah, the staff meeting is essentially boiled down. It is, we should go kick some ass, but we've been told not to kick ass. So screw it. We're going to go kick some ass anyway. And everybody goes, all right, sure. Yeah,
basically. I watched Best of Both Worlds today, too. And the first 15 minutes of Best of Both Worlds Part 1 is staff meetings.
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
and I'm like, this exactly. is, and I'm still engrossed in it. I'm like, ooh, and it didn't need to explode. I'm just like, what are they talking about? What are they staffing about?
And to be fair, there are plenty of times in Next Generation where they have staff meetings that are absolutely atrociously dull.
Yeah,
the Best of Both Worlds, the beginning of Best of Both Worlds, is not that situation though, because there's a wonderful tension to the whole thing. It's staff meetings are like, well, we're all gonna die, right? Is that pretty much, point of order, we're dead? And that's a wonderful example of having talking heads but still being compelling drama.
I think,
but
in First Contact, the primary purpose of the staff meeting at the beginning of First Contact is just to reveal Geordi's eyeballs. He's not wearing a visor anymore. That's basically
probably true, actually.
Okay, I have to say that I didn't see the movie for a long time. I don't even think I saw it in theaters, but I watched the trailer over and over again, and I just couldn't understand. Like, they would zoom in on Geordi, and there's his eye, and I'm like, the Borg assimilated Geordi's eyeball.
Only his eyeballs.
Nice.
Just his eyeball. I'm like, what?
That's how...
Nice. This does lead me to something I was gonna talk about, which is, I guess, back to our first experience of the film. I guess this was my first PG-13 film, so... I was very excited about going to see it. My parents were a little reticent. I think they waited like 4 days before actually buying tickets. And they didn't tell me. They just came home with tickets one day. I was like, oh, yay. But interesting thing about the experience of watching it is the trailers and stuff, I wasn't spoiled for the film whatsoever. And this is a film with a lot of twists and turns, a lot of reveals. So that when that Geordi's moment, the Geordi's eyes moment, it reveals like, oh, wow, Geordi has eyes now. And it's, oh, there's a new ship, and this is what it looks like. And it doesn't sit on those moments. It just keeps moving to the next one. And if there's one thing I really, really like about this movie, it's all the reveals. Mm-hmm. We learn so many things really quickly. and it's just moving from thing to thing, and it's really hard to predict where the movie's going to go once you're launched into it.
One thing you do have to give this movie, it is really well paced. It's a really wonderfully paced film. It's always moving. It never really drags. It has different speeds to it. It speeds up and it slows down, but it never, you're never feeling like, oh my God, this is too fast. What's happening? Or, you know, it, as happens plenty of time in Next Generation with staff meetings, holy God, let's get on with this.
The slowest it ever gets is like with Troy getting drunk with Cochran, but that's still, you've got Frakes having so much fun.
Yeah,
and you can tell that Frakes Sirtis dynamic is there, and James Cromwell's good. So even those scenes don't drag.
Yeah, I wrote that down too. That Frakes is obviously having a good time. Just like
he's
act like you're
time
drunk.
Of his life.
Fantastic.
And they don't spend too much time on that. I mean, that scene goes on, I think, for just the right amount of time. Where you go, okay, we've had a little bit of fun, and now it's, you know, time to move on with the story.
Yeah, like Frakes always knows when to cut back to Picard on the ship.
Yeah,
shooting things with holographic bullets.
Even holographic bullets can kill.
That's true. Well, while we're talking about reveals, one thing that I wanted to talk about was the Enterprise E itself, because I went to great lengths to, luckily back then there were no podcasts, so I wasn't doing a podcast of the, someone said, and Drew, it may have actually been you, I don't remember, someone said on Twitter like recently, imagine how hard it is to listen to Trek FM and not be spoiled about the new movie. I don't know if that was you or someone else.
Yeah, that was me.
I think so, yeah. and I kind of feel that way too, because I prefer to go into these movies not knowing anything at all. But obviously it's impossible to do a podcast and not. So, but back when First Contact came out, I was definitely trying to not find out anything. And my colleague, I worked in pre-press back then, and there, me and one other person were in this little room with a drum scanner all day, and we're both huge Trekkies. And he wanted to know about the movie, and I didn't, so it was really tough. But I was trying to dodge everything. And then one day I pull in, and I was very successful at dodging information, and I pull into the gas station, and they're doing some kind of tie-in promo for First Contact. And right at the top of the gas pumps with this giant poster with a picture of the Enterprise E. And I was like, God, I have to change gas stations now. I don't know. But anyway, unfortunately, I kind of saw it before I got there. But nevertheless, when there's that scene where they're kind of in this, it's maybe not exactly a nebula, but you know, there's a lot of dust around. It's just really beautiful shot of the Enterprise E banking around. And at that moment I thought, yeah, that's why they destroyed the D, because the Enterprise E for the big screen is just, I think, a beautiful ship.
Yeah.
It is a very pretty ship.
Yeah. It's very nice. And it's surprising they didn't have the whole, like every movie where you show it in space dock first. And they did that with the original one. They did it with we even see the B in space dock. Mm-hmm. It's just, no, here it is in space. There's not even that many shots of the E in First Contact, but it makes such a dramatic impression because it's such a great looking
ship. Plus everyone
ship.
Knew there's going to be a new ship too. Everyone's like, what's it going to look like? What's it going to look like? And then they have that scene and like, okay, great. It was just a perfect reveal.
Well, I remember feeling at that reveal, like, just, oh, there it is. Okay. Because if I remember right, I managed to avoid knowing what the ship looked like beforehand. I remember feeling like it was a little bit of an anticlimax. Okay. And I confess, I don't know how you would actually do this, because you need to spend some time before you could just jump into this point in the movie. But I feel like what would have been really, really awesome as a reveal, the one shot in the battle of with the Borg cube, where the Defiant is just getting pounded and pounded and it's just about to get destroyed, and then the Enterprise E swoops in and you really get a sense of the scale of between the two ships.
Great shot.
I mean, that would have been a hell of a reveal of like the first time
that's
you see
the first
this,
time you
this
see
new
it.
Ship.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. That would have been, that shot is wonderful to start with, but yeah, if that were the first time you saw it, that would have been very cool too.
But again,
there's precedent for that.
Again, I confess, I don't know how you would structure the movie, because there are certain things that you have to spend time on the Enterprise before that moment in order to do so.
Yeah. Well, you do if you want to have that tension of, is Picard going to be there or not, and you want to set up all of that. But I think they could have, I mean, there's precedent in the other films for not starting it with the crew. starting it with some remote outpost or with the Federation. So they could have just started it in the battle and just spend a good 5 minutes watching the battle until the Enterprise actually shows up. That could have been a really cool way to structure it.
I remember the first time I saw the ship, it was Christmas that year, 1996, mm-hmm. was it?
Mm-hmm.
96. I think it was spring or summer, though, wasn't it?
I think I saw it was November.
I think it was in autumn when it was released.
Yeah, I think so.
You might be right.
But that Christmas, my dad, that's what I got. One of my Christmas presents was the new toy. I hadn't seen the movie yet, but I had the toy. It wasn't proportioned correctly or anything, but I loved it. What I especially loved was the cloaking sound effect that it made. Nice. The toy had a cloaking device sound effect. So I'm like, okay. And then I'm reading, I had the junior novelization too, so I read through it. And I'm like, it doesn't mention anything about a cloaking device. But that makes sense. That's how they hid from the Vulcans, right? It makes more sense than you know, the moon's gravimetric field, blah, crazy. Blah, blah.
So let me ask you, Drew, the junior novelization of this movie, did it include any of the stuff going on between Data and the Borg Queen?
I don't remember that. The only thing I remember that was different was when Lily has Picard's phaser, it wasn't set to disintegrate. It was set to such a low setting that it would have just given him a rash.
Oh.
Well, the Memory Alpha does mention that the toy was based off of just like early designs. And I wonder if there was an early version of the script that had them just using a cloaking device.
Could be.
Because the model, the toy was actually not the same thing as if you actually watch the movie and compare it. It's a slightly different design.
Yeah.
Speaking of the design, I'm looking at on my wall there, I read John Eves's blog for a long time, and I won something. So he sent me a print of the original concept design for the Enterprise E.
Oh, wow.
Signed. It's really cool looking.
Is that the one with the more chicken with the front swept, whatever you call it? The nacelles are connected with a front swept bar rather than back swept?
It looks more like the Nemesis version. As he's got an article on his blog how each movie progressed closer and closer to what his original concept was.
Interesting.
But they would have finally gotten to it had they gone on. Like, that's what part of the refit was when it was in space dock the last time that we see it. We do see it in a space dock, but it's two movies later.
Very cool.
Yeah, we saw it at the end. All right, well, why don't we talk about, I guess, one of the key elements in this movie, the evolution of the Borg themselves.
Right, or the transition, or the changing, or the retconning of Best of Both Worlds, as I like to call it.
Yeah, the unfortunate defanging or declawing of the Borg, which, as I think we talked about in an episode a long time ago, I mean, Voyager gets a lot of blame for, and rightly so, for really neutering the Borg in a big way. But you have to remember to lay some of that at the feet of Next Generation, because it happens in the later seasons of Next Generation where they pull in the Borg several times and try to give them more personality, and, you know, with when Lore takes over them and that sort of thing. But I think First Contact is another step down that path, and a fairly large one. And I like in theory the concept of the Borg Queen, but it still to me seems like a dilution of the real strength of the Borg as a villain. The Borg are the greatest villain is not another person, another character that thinks more or less like you do and who can be reasoned with. A real terrifying villain is something that's akin to a force of nature that will just roll over you. A giant space ant colony that is going to devour you no matter what. And that's what the Borg are in the beginning and were introduced as. And that's where the real terror comes from, in my opinion. And while somewhat interesting, especially with the Borg Queen, I think it takes them away from force of nature aspect, that quality.
Yeah. And it really reeks of a studio note. I mean, I'd love to read the original Resurrection script, but you know, it was just going to be the Borg take over the ship, and at some point, you know, came down from on high, can't you make them a little bit more, you know, less like zombies?
Yeah.
And I mean, okay, I do think they did a good job of it, bringing Data into it, having them temp Data. That wouldn't have been as interesting if there hadn't been the Borg Queen. But all of these lines, like, oh, when it really bugs me when Picard meets her and he's like, oh, I do remember you. You were there the whole time. It's just like, it's this terrible, as you know, retconning.
Right.
It's like, oh, yes, this character you've never seen before that didn't make any sense. And when he says stuff like, oh, I remember, it wasn't enough that you assimilated me. I had to come willingly. Like, no, that wasn't the point.
Right.
The point was there wasn't someone like the Borg Queen who could be a figurehead. So the Borg wanted a figurehead. So they picked you.
Right.
Yeah.
So they constructed you for that sole purpose, for this specific situation, because they don't have somebody to do that on staff.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So exactly. It's because you didn't exist, this episode happened.
So Mike, I see you're nodding very strongly to that. So what do you think about the Borg Queen?
No, I just agreed with what Greg was saying, but I think to add to that, I think what would have made a much better backstory for the Borg Queen in the movie would be to say that because they lost Locutus, they had to establish a spokesperson and create the Queen because of that, rather than her being there the whole time and making up a bunch of hogwash story that doesn't really... Why if she was there, why wouldn't they show her in Best of Both Worlds? Because that would have been awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I mean,
I tried to imagine what the Queen would look like in that environment, and it didn't fit. Like the bright white and the clean and the nice and the pretty, and I'm like, I can't see Alice Craig in there.
Mm.
Yeah, it probably would have been like a B actress from a TV show, and her hair would be there, but she'd have like an eyepiece. You know, nothing menacing.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you definitely have to give this film, one thing we talk about the evolution is the advancing of the makeup. I mean, go back to iBorg and look at that what they built for Hugh. It's just a couple things. You know, they give him pancake makeup and a couple model kits pasted onto his face.
Yeah.
And the black mesh bodysuits with some, you know, motherboards painted black tape to it. I mean, that's that's the extent of it. Yeah.
Right. And they did so much here. And you know, Memory Alpha again, they even made some Klingons, and you definitely see the Klingon Borg in it, but they really expanded and it continued into Voyager, where they were much more interesting looking. So that's at least one positive thing that
you
came
do
out
see
of this.
That they are developing, they're assimilating other races, not just humans all the time at this point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I do feel bad for the Voyager customers who, you know, had the bar raised so highly by First Contact. And then, you know, but on a feature film budget with a feature film schedule and all the luxuries that affords, that, you know, the kind of luxuries that you don't have in television at all. Yeah. And that's why you get things like the Borg looking the way they do when they first get introduced. Because, like, okay, we're shooting tomorrow in white makeup and motherboards. Go, just go. So then the bar gets raised and the Voyager people have to conform to that higher bar and on, you know, a much tighter schedule and budget.
At least Voyager had the costumes left over from
that's
First
true.
Contact.
That's probably
that
why
they
were able to.
Recycling. Yeah. And I've been watching a lot of Voyager lately. And I'm not. I love all of them. And Voyager, this is like my third or fourth time watching through
really
it.
Oh, sorry.
You
I'm sorry.
It grows on me more every time, but I'm into a lot of the Borg episodes now, and one of the things I was thinking about is like going back and looking at Q Who and comparing like what they look like and wondering like what the heck is wrong with Jean-Luc Picard's mind when they assimilate him in Best of Both Worlds, and then that's what they turn into.
Right.
I'm gonna bring up a controversial point, especially with Brian's reaction to Voyager. But
okay.
I mean, my dad also, around the same time that First Contact came out, he bought me the Star Trek Encyclopedia first printing edition.
Yep,
first edition.
I had that too.
And I read it. I was homeschooled. That's what I did when I wasn't learning. I was reading the encyclopedia.
We had similar childhoods, apparently.
I say, Greg and Drew, are you guys actually brothers or something? I don't know here.
So I I basically have everything from like from the original series to like season 3 of Deep Space Nine completely memorized. So, but I'd never seen too many episodes. So my first real experience of seeing the Borg was First Contact.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So to me, the TNG representation, I have the Borg collective DVD set, and watching the original Borg episodes is really weird for me because, you know, I watched First Contact and all of Voyager. So yeah. To me, that is the Borg. So it's weird to see them without a queen. Mm-hmm. And with the pancake makeup and more zombie-like.
It's similar in the way to Klingons. You know, to me, a Klingon looks like Worf. And going back to those original series episodes, I'm like, what is this? This Fu Manchu mustache and, you know, what's going on here? But to some people, that's what Klingons look like. And this new stuff, well, this is the new stuff to them. But yeah, I'm the same way with First Contact and then Voyager. That's just what the Borg look like. And anything else is, well, I guess they just didn't have money and it's just not as interesting. And I hate to say that, but yeah, there's a certain punch taken away when I watch Best of Both Worlds because it's not as cool looking.
It's not as cool looking, but I think the Borg were more menacing at that point. And then as TNG, like Brian said, as TNG went on, you get a few things. You get Hugh. So here, suddenly you have a Borg who can somehow exist and interact and become friends with Geordi and all kinds of things, you know. And then you get the whole deal with Lore, and then the Borg get a logo. And I think, Greg, you and I were talking about this the other day.
Right.
Why do the Borg need a logo? But suddenly the Borg have a logo, and then you get into First Contact. And I like the Borg Queen fine, and the concept, it works fine for me. I don't have any problem with it. But it did open the door for some of the ridiculous things on Voyager, like Janeway negotiating with the Borg and creating a pact with the Borg, which was just... I mean, at that point, the Borg just... They just become like the Romulans or the Klingons or anyone else. They're just another alien race that's a player in galactic politics, well, I mean, you know?
Yeah, there was the episode where they got intentionally assimilated.
Yeah. Yeah,
just that's assuming the final that they nail could undo coffin. It.
Yeah,
like my God, this isn't like with the Romulans where you can just put on some makeup and then take it off. No, you're going, you're getting nanobots put into your blood, and there's like stuff popping out. You can't just do that. But apparently, if it's Voyager, you can. So yeah, that's
Holodoc can make lungs. Holographic.
We just
lungs
talked about
to
that in
alive.
The news today.
We
did. That's right.
Were you listening to the news, Drew?
No, I always skip the news because I don't want spoilers. Oh,
I learned that this week.
Now,
shame
Drew,
on you.
There are. If you get the show from iTunes anyway, there are chapter markers, and it's always marked movie news and rumors. So you can listen to all the rest of the news, and you can skip the movie news and rumors. And movie news and rumors is always last. All right. Well, so the Borg went on anyway, and obviously their evolution in this movie, they're kind of a mix. You've kind of got zombies with the drones, but then you've got the Borg Queen and all her plotting and scheming and wanting Data to have skin and be fully functional and all kinds of stuff that, again, was not in the junior novel edition of this story.
But, right.
Greg, you brought up another thing in the other side of the room that you thought that there is someone who may have made a better Zefram Cochrane than James Cromwell.
Now let me be extremely, extremely clear. I like James Cromwell. I think he's a really good actor. I like him in all of his other roles. He was on an episode of TNG I just watched, Birthright. He did a really good job in that one.
He's on a couple. He's under really heavy makeup under one, but yeah.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with him, and definitely there's even nothing wrong with his performance in First Contact. But they were originally wanting to get Tom Hanks. And just think about this with me, guys. 1996 Tom Hanks, imagine him in that role. And I just think it would have been so much better. These scenes.
Okay, no. Now
it would have been much.
I say this as a huge Tom Hanks fan.
Apollo 13. We're talking Apollo 13 time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, all right. Apollo 13 Go was ahead. 95 the year before.
Okay.
Right.
But what about 1986?
That's what I was going to say.
Eddie Murphy.
Oh, no. I was going to say in Bosom Buddies.
No, like 19.
Can you imagine Zefram Cochran in drag? I mean, how interesting would that have been?
But now here was what I was, because I was always under the impression that, yeah, it was Tom Hanks first, and then because he was directing That Thing You Do at the time, he couldn't right. do it, scheduling. So they went to James Cromwell. But reading the Memory Alpha for First Contact, apparently, they wrote it for James Cromwell. He had just done Babe, so he was a big deal now. But they wrote it with him in mind. And Tom Hanks is a huge Star Trek fan, a huge mm-hmm. Star Trek space, science fiction, everything fan. And so he lobbied really hard to get the part. And I would imagine it was one of those situations where it was like, Tom Hanks really wants to do our movie. You really don't say no yeah. to that, so especially 1996 Tom Hanks. But then it turned out that he couldn't do it. So they went with their original. That's just what I'm reading from Memory Alpha.
I don't buy James Cromwell. This character, who's he? What is he supposed to be? Is he supposed to be, I'm assuming, like a scientist who got messed up in the war, but he still was able to do this stuff. I don't, when I look at James Cromwell in this film, I don't see scientist turned drunk. I just see drunk. I see old drunk is what I see, which is fine if that's who he's playing. But how did he invent warp drive?
Well,
how did this guy he's playing?
Yeah.
Whereas if it's Tom Hanks, I've got all this Tom Hanks in my head and I'm thinking about it and he looks like he could have been a scientist at some
Maybe.
Point, you know, give him some nerdy glasses.
But the only thing is, if they had written the character as a drunk and Tom Hanks were playing and Tom Hanks was a drunk and then he played Ooby Dooby and got Troy drunk on tequila and so forth.
Oh, it would have been fun. It'd
would
be
it
like,
make any difference?
I love Tom Hanks, but I wouldn't have bought it.
Yeah,
I think it would have lowered Tom Hanks.
Man.
I mean, and he was coming off Forrest Gump, too. I mean, Academy Award winner Tom Hanks. Dancing to Ooby Dooby with Vulcans. I mean, I think even he would have been like, you know what? Maybe not.
They would have had to do some rewrites, which is fine. I mean, we might have just gotten a different character and that would have been different. I will say I really do like the idea, the thematic idea of, okay, here's this hero. It's somebody who is built up as a hero in your mind. And then you go back and you meet your heroes. And then, you know, it's a cliche to say never meet your heroes. But the, you know, there's kind of the arc for him is he ends up growing into this role that these people have come back and demonstrated for him. And you eventually see, and I think it could be clear. I think it could be stronger to the sense that, you know, okay, he's now on this trajectory that will take him to become the person that they all know and revere. But I like that idea. I like, here's this broken guy who, you know, maybe he had dreams at one point and now he's just like lying when he says he's just in it for the money and for women, or maybe he really was, but, you know, getting this glimpse into this world gives him the different perspective that, you know, changes him either way. But this idea that he goes from this, you know, point where he's not at all what they think he is and eventually grows into that. I really like that.
And don't ever try to tie him into the Metamorphosis, Zefram Cochran.
Yeah, just don't bother.
I watched that a couple weeks ago, and I'm like, that's not at all.
No.
What?
Yeah, there's several non-canon novels, including one that explains that Zefram Cochran had radiation damage, and that's why he looks old. He's not
the general idea. Yeah,
yeah. But I don't buy it really.
But how many people have played Jack Ryan in various movies? How many people have played Hamlet in various productions? Just sometimes a different actor plays a different actor plays the same character. Just deal with it, move on.
Yeah. Well, this sort of leads us to another thing I wanted to talk about, which was some of the original ideas for what became First Contact. And I guess just stepping back, the original concept for this specific film was that Cochran would actually become injured during the Borg's attack. And Picard sort of it was past tense, right, Chris? Where Sisko steps into the Bell Riots.
Yeah, and becomes the historical figure,
Right, so you'd have Picard taking over for Zefram Cochran. What do you guys think of that as a concept? So you have Riker fighting the Borg on the ship, Picard falling in love with a reporter and launching the first warp drive?
It's fine. I like past tense, and I like that basic idea, but I'm glad they went this way, because especially with things like Star Trek, you have a tendency in these franchise things where, like, the same four people are responsible for everything, everywhere, every time. Mm-hmm. And yeah. This had that been the case here, that just would have been another instance of it. So I'm glad it's more of a, you know, we're here for it and we play a role, but it's still the actual people. And it's still ultimately their day in the end.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Give them their day.
What was the episode, Chris, we were talking about where Geordi is saying, it would be like being there with Zefram Cochrane on the first warp flight. It was like fourth or fifth season.
Yeah.
It's the one with the Soliton wave.
Whatever the wave that they're trying to carry.
I can't
find on the list of episodes now. I've been trying.
I can remember Soliton Wave, but I can't remember the name of the episode. But
exactly,
I know what you're talking about. Yeah,
but yeah, it's such a good moment. Yeah, because you have Geordi and Riker, and they're helping him, but no, they're there with Cochrane.
New ground.
Cochrane's actually making it, and it leads. What was it?
New ground.
Okay.
New ground. Mm. Okay. There you go. Yep. Yeah. Go back and watch that one just for Geordi's line, because it's now that you've seen First Contact, that line is like, oh yeah, that's pretty cool. But yeah, if that had been Picard, it would have felt like such a, and what would have then happened? They would have healed Zefram Cochrane and been like, oh yeah, just tell people you totally invented warp, tell them you went on the flight and all this stuff.
Welcome back.
It's not
glad
quite,
you're okay.
You don't end up with the same Cochrane.
Welcome back. Glad you're okay.
We totally
by the way,
made history
for the
you.
Rest of history, you have to pretend this thing. So yes. Long now. Bye-bye.
Probably right. Crusher would have just implanted some memory engrams into his brain that makes him believe he went on the warp flight, and
which would then immediately fail because Crusher can't do that.
Then he would die, and they would have to do it all over again. They do the whole movie like 17 times, and then finally at the end,
right.
They wait. That was another episode.
Star Trek: Groundhog's Day.
Yes, one more time.
Yeah.
Well, okay, then let's open up to the panel again. How about 15th century England? And there's a spooky haunted house.
I went there once. It was a very
haunted
castle.
Place.
Really? Now, is this where Lily is going to fall in love with an Irish ghost that had possessed and had love affairs with all of Dr. Crusher's family over the centuries?
I don't remember reading that one on Memory Alpha.
I don't know. I don't think I would have been very interested in that plot. Now, the first one about Picard taking Cochrane's place, I would have probably been fine with that if they had gone that way. I don't know. This 15th century one, yeah, I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that it would be pulled apart maybe by history buffs. I mean, going back to like today is really easy to do, but going back to a historical period in our actual past would be a little too much. In this one, I like that they went into the past, but to their past, but our future, so they could still play with it and do what they wanted with it. But and so you don't really like that's not how it happened.
Because I mean, you think Trekkies are bad about nitpicking things? Wait till you get into those 15th century historical reenactors. They are just really, really difficult to deal with. They would just pick it apart. Yeah. There'd be books published about it and everything. So it's a good thing the studio.
Or another idea they floated was the American Civil War, and that's another history. It's another era of history that people get very invested in the details of.
Yeah. Let's leave those to Q episodes. I mean, Q put them in Robin Hood. Q took us to the Q Civil War that looked like the American Civil War. That's fine, because Q doesn't really know what he's doing, and it's just play acting. But if they'd actually tried to do it for reals, I would have. This is a case of Brandon and Ronald kept thinking and thinking and thinking, and I think they hit on probably, and you guys can debate me on this, the best concept for a Star Trek film that they've had. I mean, I know it's no whale probe, but I think it's still pretty good.
Well, it's certainly no Moby Dick from Moby Dick's point of view. That's for sure. But yeah, I agree.
It's Moby Dick with time travel and hero worship.
Well, no, I'm saying, you know, Wrath of Khan is essentially Moby Dick, where Moby Dick is the hero of and you follow right. you yep. follow around. Kirk is that's the white whale that is, of Wrath yep. of Khan. But anyway,
and that is cool.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know. I don't know how you would possibly make any of those real history era aspects work, especially something as kind of inherently fruity as the Renaissance or medieval England. I don't mean to be derogatory in that sense, but Star Trek already is kind of goofy and stilted, I guess, is the mm-hmm. word I'm looking for. Shakespearean, another word to, then if you mm-hmm. if you put it into that kind of setting or any one of those settings, I don't think it would have been a good combination.
Yeah,
I can't see a Star Trek crew lasting more than 3 minutes before trying to explain, no, we're from the future.
Yeah. And if it's
I've been listening to the Delta Quadrant, and that's what they're this like. Janeway spins yes. about 5 seconds before she's like, and we're aliens from another planet.
Right.
They had a hard enough time convincing Cochrane, who knows that space travel is possible, but if it's like 15th century England, it's like, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, one, I mean, then it's then it becomes a Connecticut Yankee kind of a thing, which mm-hmm. could work, but I don't see Star Trek pulling it off. I especially don't see Braga and Moore pulling it off, but that's me.
Well, the one thing is, and now I'm time zero. That's probably the most they've done of going back to a time period and trying to deal with it, and it's close. I mean, I don't know. Samuel Clemens is a bit much for me in that. So if they try to do a whole movie and try to do it like they did Time Zero, yeah, it would have been a bit of a stretch. Is there another time they've done that where they've really gone to our
like
past?
Truly gone to the past.
City on the Edge of Forever.
Oh, okay. Okay. Original series aside, but I guess
there's
you're
I mean,
right
Enterprise did it with
Carbon Creek.
Carbon Creek, yeah. And they did it at the end of the Zindi arc. So,
the Little Zindi was sort of an alternate history. Little Green Men
Little
did
Green
it really well.
Great.
It wasn't really the crew going, was it? Wasn't it just the Ferengi?
Just Ferengi. Odo was with them.
And Odo.
And Rob. Yeah.
Oh, yes. So yes. Little Green Men and Carbon Creek are two of my favorite episodes of Star Trek, actually.
But you're talking about them going back
so
in time to actually kind of to stop something
when it's the
from
actual
happening.
Ship.
Not an accidental
right.
thing.
When you're going, like the whole crew traveling to try to prevent something, I don't think it turns out very... I guess there's, what was the failed start... Gene Roddenberry's failed pilot?
Oh, the backdoor pilot with
the backdoor
Gary
pilot.
Seven.
Oh, yeah,
Gary
yeah.
Seven.
Yeah.
Was it Assignment Earth?
Assignment Earth. That's
it.
Yes.
Yeah, we're gonna do that.
That's not one of Star Trek's
prouder moments. No, that's true.
It was an unusual episode for sure.
Hey, at least we never got Roddenberry's that movie that he kept pitching every movie. Like they go back in time, the original series, they go back in time to stop Kennedy's assassination. Yeah. Ends up that Spock has
really?
To pull the trigger.
Wow, I hadn't heard of that.
Yeah, every movie it was. Roddenberry would pitch they're in college still, what became Star Trek 09, I guess, that same kind of concept, and they go back in time to stop the Kennedy assassination. It was always those two things. I think Shatner mentions it. In, movie memories.
Definitely glad we didn't get that one then.
Yeah, not interested in that story.
So can we all agree that they hit on a good concept? So, I think. Who was it that was saying they Mike, you really like this film, right?
Yeah, I do. It's definitely my favorite, especially of the Next Gen movies.
Yeah, so like, where does it really, when we have these complaints, like, really neuters the Borg, or it's a little, there's the silliness, where is it hitting on all cylinders for you?
I don't agree really that it neuters the Borg, but it definitely changed the way we view them quite a bit. I have no problem with the goofiness. If you know, if I go to a Star Trek movie and I don't laugh at least a few times, then I think they failed.
Where it's supposed to be funny, right. or just laughing at it. Because I laughed a lot at Insurrection. So.
Yeah, I'm not talking about the motion picture.
Too much junk.
Right. No, but, this was an intentionally funny movie. You're right about that. There's a lot of actual funny moments. That's very true.
Especially the stuff on Earth and with Cochran. One of my favorite moments in the movie is definitely when Lieutenant Barclay shows up. And I really wish that he would have been in it more and played a little bit bigger of a part, but he was only in, like, what, a minute?
Yeah.
But that was a really cool moment. But yeah, stuff like that in the movie I think is great. Mm. And I definitely agree with you that with Greg that like the drunk aspect of Cromwell playing the part was just a little bit too much. Like, you think, really, this guy built this whole ship and invented this warp drive, but he's kind of a stumbling drunk. Like, I mean, I kind of agree with that, but it definitely played well for the drama and the character in the movie. But that's definitely something that I kind of thought about several times myself, like that maybe it was a little overplayed.
Yeah, they needed him to be difficult or unwilling to help them otherwise. I mean, if he was this great scientist who just really, really wanted to get that ship launched, then everything would have been easy for them, right?
Yeah.
But by setting him up to be difficult, they had to find a way to do it, and then it kind of doesn't mesh with that. But then again, I have to say, we can talk about it that way, but when I'm watching the movie, it doesn't really bother me that much, you know, that the character's written that way. It works okay for me.
Well, which do you think is the A story and which is the B story? You've got Picard on the ship, you've got Riker on the... And I've heard it described both ways.
Clearly the A story is Troy doing the countdown for the launch, where there's like nothing for Troy to do in this movie. So it's like, why don't we bring this person who just arrived on the planet, put her in the control room, and she's going to do the countdown for the launch. The B story is, of course, the whole saving Earth from the Borg kind of thing here.
It is called First Contact. Yes. So, I mean...
Yeah, but it was almost called Star Trek Borg. So, you know, I think they were just kind of... They were flipping coins or throwing darts at a board by the end there.
The title really did confuse me when I... You know, because I was okay, First Contact with the Borg? They had First Contact.
Right.
Like many contacts.
Well,
that's true.
Well, it's going to be Resurrection until
Alien 3 announced.
Alien Resurrection.
Or Alien 4, yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't even know what that title would have meant. Like, who was being resurrected?
It's probably because Cochran, the ship was named Phoenix or something, but
yeah,
I don't know.
Okay, could it Star Trek
First
Phoenix?
Contact, it made me think it was going to be a movie about Riker and his exploits, or I don't know.
It's all space Lilith, right?
That's why Drew watched the wrong story in preparing for this.
Right.
This ready room.
Hey, BB Newworth is hot. I don't care what any of you say.
She is.
It's true.
Smoking. It's
true. I agree. Watching maybe episode 6 of Frasier, and they're talking about how like horrible Lilith is, and I'm just like, you know, I know what Lilith looks like. I don't know who you're fooling. Like, no.
Yeah.
I don't care.
But Chris, you mentioned that nobody has anything to do, really.
No, Troy has nothing to do in this movie. Yeah.
Right, Troy. But I feel that way about all the Next Generation movies. That it's Picard or Data, or Picard and Data.
Well, it's true.
It's like the A story is Picard and the B story is Data. In each one of them, Data has an emotion chip. Picard, you know, wants to fight the
Nexus.
Well,
why do you think in Generations that LeVar Burton lobbied so strongly to make sure he got to do that barrel roll?
You are obsessed with the barrel roll, my friend. You bring up the barrel roll every time I'm here.
I just watched Starship Mine, and one of the terrorists does a barrel roll. I was very impressed.
Is it Tim Russ? Because if it's Tim Russ, then he's probably just, you know, like, oh, well, I didn't get cast as Geordi, but by God, I'm going to do the damn barrel roll.
Do the barrel roll, yeah. Absolutely. But it's true. It's always, and it's kind of one of the things, not to get into other I don't want to get into Deep Space Nine here again, because we always bring up Deep Space Nine no matter what we're talking about. But one thing I really like in Deep Space Nine is that all the characters have something to do all the time. Not only the main cast, but they've got like 20 people all together, and they all have stuff to do. Yeah. And when you get into the, you know, the original series, it's always Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, and no one else has very much to do. That's why, you know, Chekhov has to fall off a ship and go to the hospital because he has nothing to do. And
or Scotty has to kill a hooker.
Yeah. That's right. So that happens. And then here yet is always very much just Picard and Data, because that's who the fans like. Oh. But I like to see everyone have more of a role, personally.
Yeah. I think it's because we spent 7 years with these people, and everyone had several episodes, like many episodes, particularly about them. Whereas with the original series, there was only 3 seasons. It really only focused on Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. So it was a natural evolution to film.
Yeah.
But there's no way you could do a film that gave every character like enough screen time to actually please, you know, all the fans.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and I know we've talked about this, I guess, a long time ago, but the basic difference between a television show and a film is, with a television show, you just have so much more time in the final analysis. You have, you know, 24, 20-something hours each year, each season, compared to 2 hours for every movie. So, you know, that's why shows have 7 or 8 characters, so you have more people go, okay, well, this week we're going to go on character number 7, and it'll be a Sulu episode or a Crusher episode or whatever. And you have to be much more efficient with your time, and that's probably, not that I've ever done it myself, but I would wager that that's probably the most difficult aspect of adapting something like a television show to the big screen is, okay, you've got 10 characters, but Now in this movie, you only have time for 2 or maybe 3. And it's just, there's just a, I think the laws of physics as far as, you know, movies and TV go.
So basically on Enterprise, they said, you know, we have time. We have at first 26 episodes and then 24 and then 22. But that Mayweather guy, screw it. We're just not going to write anything for him. It's basically, they had the time. They just didn't have the inclination, basically.
Right. With Enterprise, they follow that rule of, okay, well, it's a TV show, so we have all this time, so we better have all these characters. And then at some points, way too late, they realized, oh, these are not actual characters at all. These are just cardboard cutouts of human beings that...
Yeah, they only wrote for a few of the characters, and they just kind of forgot that they had the others around.
I mean, if Mayweather is the clearest example, but I mean, Mayweather is... I think it's a problem with most of the characters on Enterprise, but Mayweather is the clearest in the sense that there's just nothing to this guy. Nothing dramatically is going on with him whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, maybe a perfectly valid, you know, human being in that world. Most of Starfleet may be people like Mayweather, but as far as the TV show goes, as far as spending time watching, being compelled to watch this guy, there's just nothing there.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the dialogue a little bit, because, Greg, you said you wanted to cover a number of topics here regarding dialogue.
Yeah. Well, it was just standing out to me because, as I said last week, I've really been injecting myself with TNG recently. And it really came across this time watching First Contact that there's just not... It's not the same. All the lines are like... you know, 3 to 7 words long. You know, there's assimilate this, or, you know, various things like that. And you know, blow up the damn ship. And that's the sort of, there's even those deep conversations are still these like little lines that are like trailer lines. And I feel like 75% of this film is trailer lines. And that's got to be a problem, right?
A lot of it, although I will say that, there are moments in the movie. I think the whole conversation between the crew and Zefram Cochrane down the planet is quite good, and it's good TNG. And Picard's conversations with Lily are quite good and are good TNG. Yeah. But there is, compared to most of TNG, which is a very, very talky series and often gets very philosophical, there's not as much of it in here. As you like Insurrection... Yeah. which is a movie that I quite like, which I know a lot of people don't like. The reason I like Insurrection is that it really does dig deeper into the core of what TNG is about for me. Whereas First Contact, yeah, there, maybe I guess you're right. There are a lot of trailer lines in here, and it just does keep the pace moving along. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, I watched Frame of Mind and Birthright, which are both written by Brandon Braga, and they have some of the best dialogue in Star Trek that I've ever heard. And where is that? I mean, yes, it's in the Lily scene. It's in the Lily scenes. It's a little bit there on Earth, but it's, I feel like it's all this. This is a script that kept getting punched up, and it is missing a little bit of that TNG feeling of let's just let these characters say what's on their mind and figure out these philosophical issues. I mean, Drew, what'd you think of the dialogue?
Well,
comparing Best of Both Worlds to, I mean, because you just watched that.
Yeah, it does seem that the writing in First Contact is more trailer lines and more exciting and let's get to the point and stuff for like a general audience. But I noticed that there's really not like an introduction of any characters. Like you have to,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, like if I hadn't memorized the encyclopedia, I would be completely lost watching that movie. And the dialogue doesn't give you anything because it's all just punch, punch, punch.
Well, no. There's the scene where Lily meets Worf and he says, I am a Klingon.
That's right. So then you know.
Do you really need more than that? I mean, that's basically his entire life story.
I don't know. I don't know if I agree personally. I think, I mean, yeah, sure, there's a lot. But in any film, most of the dialogue is just plot driven. It's to get you from plot point A to plot point B. But somewhere in there, you have somebody say something in the general vicinity of what the movie is supposedly about. But I think that exists as much as any kind of theme exists in First Contacts, both in the scene between Lily and Picard, you know, the Ahab Moby Dick scene, and with the other story, you know, talking about what kind of person Zefram Cochrane is or is going to be in, you know, history and all of that. So I don't think I agree personally. I think it may not be, it may be a little more than other movies, or it may not be quite as much as the television show, but I don't think it's out of the bounds.
I think it's normal as movies go, but amongst the TNG movies themselves, there's less dialogue than in the other TNG movies. But as any average movie goes, it's probably, yeah, pretty normal. And there are some other scenes with Picard and Lily as well. There are actually quite a few scenes with Picard and Lily where he delivers a good deal of information both about the universe and the philosophy of the future. There's the whole thing about the no money, which we can has been picked out and debated extensively. Mm-hmm. Another thing I wanted to mention before I forget about it was one thing that I do love about First Contact, and Drew, like you said, if you are someone who's not familiar with TNG and you go watch this movie, you could be quite lost. But I think with the JJ movie, they kind of went overboard in a way of trying to reintroduce all the characters to the point where there's almost no story because they simply don't have time for a story because it's all, here's how they all met. I love that in First Contact, they go through the series and they pick out all these little tidbits that are so perfect for the fans. I love the fact that in order to get the transceiver or whatever they got out of the Borg that Picard got, that they went to the holodeck, and not only did they go to the holodeck, but he punches up the big goodbye. He punches up a story from the first season in the holodeck that we know. And he never says it. It's just on the screen. So you're watching as a fan, and he starts punching it in. It says the big goodbye chapter, whatever. I thought it's a very cool moment. And I think Star Trek's a franchise where you can get away with that. And the movie's still exciting for the general audience, but it has so much stuff in it for the fans as well.
I agree. There's a good blend. There's a lot of nice touches of just here's this world that has already been built in all of these various aspects over all these other various, you know, moments, from Cochrane to the big goodbye to the emergency medical hologram. And just, you know, they're just pieces of that world that already exist and are taken advantage of in the logical course of the situation that these particular people find themselves in. And it's not, oh, we're
and,
not
and
stopping.
Captain Frazier. Let's not forget.
Yeah. And we're not stopping and going, yes, this is the, you remember the holodeck episodes from the, you know, where Picard played the Maltese Falcon. It's like, no, it's just, here it is. And it, you know, we're not going to stop and wink at the camera, wink at the audience about it. But it's, if we have to go somewhere, it might as well be here because we have already seen this corner.
Yeah.
That's true.
That's something you mentioned there, Greg, which I think really slips by people, the fact that during the battle with the Borg at the beginning, that Captain Frazier's voice is actually in there.
Yeah.
I'd always thought that was an urban legend until I was watching it tonight with my headphones in, and I'm like, my goodness, it's Kelsey Grammer.
I think so. I mean, once I read that, I went back and listened, and I'm pretty. Yeah.
I still don't see the Millennium Falcon, which is apparently in some shot somewhere. I
saw it on the laser disc once.
Okay.
At a friend's house, he had the laser disc, and so we were going back and forth between.
Yeah, isn't R2-D2 floating through the wreckage or something like that? Also,
that's 09.
That's 09.
Yeah, I think that's 2009.
Has R2 in the wreckage, which I've not seen that either.
You can't see anything in that wreckage. It's just.
Yeah,
tons of junk.
It's kind of cool that they
the
you know, slide all that stuff in there, but
yeah,
anyway, it's cool that they pulled out the ship, you know, from Cause and Effect and put that in there and actually had it participating in the battle. You have this old, we talked about this, was it last week or the week before, the old Bozeman being in there, and then Kelsey Grammer
it's great. I mean, yeah. I mean, you can tell it's a film written by people who've been writing the show for years. You know, I'm glad they didn't try to bring in some new writers. I'm especially glad, according to Memory Alpha, they went to a bunch of big name directors before being like, well, I guess we could let Frakes do it. I think Frakes was the perfect director for this film.
Yeah.
He'd been preparing for it. I mean, you look at the episodes he did, and apparently looking at First Contact. I mean, this is the first feature film he'd ever made. And it's probably his best film. I mean, I love his other TV work too, but this is a really good film, especially by a first-time director.
It was the perfect material for him. You know, thank goodness Stuart Baird was busy when First Contact came around and they didn't bring him in for that.
Yeah.
It's like, you know that...
He's the guy who did Nemesis, right? Who thought Geordi was an alien or something?
Yeah, and he thought the ship had elevators on it, and he wanted to cut the entire Troy Riker wedding out of the movie, and...
But yeah,
who needs that? Nobody cares about this. It has nothing to do with the story. No, people just been waiting, you know, 20 years for them to get married. That's all. However long that was. But to also talk about dialogue, I do have to say that the whole quote that's pulled out of Moby Dick that Patrick Stewart delivers to Lily is one of my favorite moments in Star Trek. Actually, that delivery.
Yeah, I agree.
And I don't think Patrick Stewart had to deliver that. I can't imagine anyone else delivering that and having it connect with me the way that it did. So there are great dialogue moments.
They attack us and we fall back.
Did have a little.
I was going to do that. I was thinking about it. I'm like,
this far, no farther.
The line must be drawn.
Here.
Here.
So figure out how to spell that. But.
I will make them pay for what they have done.
For what they've done?
Well, look at it this way. It's just, you know, they picked up the big goodbye. They picked up all these elements. They had Kelsey Grammer's voice in there. And Patrick Stewart was doing his homage to William Shatner in that scene. So,
right.
Bringing it full circle, original series, to the Next Generation.
Yes.
And we can't forget that Zefram Cochrane actually uses the words Star Trek.
Okay, I wanted to ask you guys about this because I know a lot of people think that whole scene is really corny. I actually love that they were able to fit that in. I think they had been wanting to do that for a long time from what I've heard. But it has to work in the moment. I personally thought it worked really well.
Yeah.
I thought it was really cool to say, you people, you are all astronauts on some sort of Star Trek. And it sounded... In the moment, it worked for me. How did you feel about it?
I don't know, it doesn't.
It's a thing that no one would ever say. Yeah. I mean,
When is the last time you have ever described anything other than the TV show we're talking about right now as a Star Trek? Nobody in the
or a Trek at all of any sort.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, how often do you use the word Trek? Just that. Nobody would ever say that in a real conversation.
You know, I mean, they did use Star Trek to describe a friend of the show, Lieutenant Commander Ben McCormick's favorite movie, Space Voyage 2009 by J.J. Abrams. they used Star Trek to describe
it's
that.
Famous so. Descriptive.
Yeah.
Right. I would agree that it's not something that you would normally say, but I did think that it fit in well enough that it was just an opportunity to drop it in. And as a fan, going all the way back to, you know, the 70s when I was watching TOS and reruns when I was a kid, I enjoyed seeing that in the script, personally. It was
you
kind
know
of
what
a
it
nice
reminds me of? It reminds me of that Upright Citizens Brigade sketch.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, when they briefly had a TV show, they have a sketch where a guy comes into a video store and he claims to be the one that says the title line in every movie ever made.
Titular role.
The titular role, yes. Oh, I'm the one nice. That actually said the word Star Wars in Star Wars. And the other guy's like, nobody ever nice. Says the word Star Wars. And he goes, no, sure, it's on the Millennium Falcon. I walk in, I go, boy, I sure am tired of all these Star Wars. And it's like, that's to me, they are one and the same. Because nobody would ever say either of those two phrases in any situation whatsoever.
So he's also the guy that walked into the room with Carrie Fisher and said, boy, you know, I really do remember very well that time when Harry met Sally. It was...
yeah.
That was quite a night.
I am awfully sleepless in Seattle.
He said that before, Greg.
We're going to die hard with a vengeance.
Okay, absolutely. So, okay, we're past an hour again. So I guess at closing here, the last topic to talk about and to circle around from the very beginning, how has this movie stood the test of time for you? I think most fans, the first time they saw First Contact, thought it was a wonderful movie. I know I certainly did, that it was, I think it was what are the high points for TNG. There are a couple of episodes where I think TNG hit its high point, and then this movie for me as well. And as I rewatch it, it still holds up really well for me. You know, I see a few things here and there where I think, yeah, maybe this didn't quite work as well as I remember. But it's still one of my... it's probably The Wrath of Khan and First Contact are the two best Star Trek movies in my book. But Greg, you've told me before a while back, it's been many months ago, but we were talking about First Contact, and you mentioned that as you rewatched First Contact after many years, you didn't think it was quite as great as you remembered it. So how about for each of us, how has it stood the test of time?
I'd say that it's still my favorite of the next-gen films, but as Brian said, that's a low bar. It's up there. It's Search for Spock, right around with First Contact, and then Wrath of Khan, Star Trek VI. It's right up there. But it's not up there with my favorite next-gen episodes, and I think that's my problem. As a movie, like, going back to Dork Trek, as a movie, it's great. But as Star Trek, you know, it's a movie. But it's a fun one. It's something. What's really great about it is you really can bring new people into the franchise with this one. This is a movie you can show people, get them excited about Star Trek, and then show them the show. And it's a good lead in that way.
How about you, Mike?
I think, like with any movie or TV show, over time it's going to lose a little bit of something just with everything new that's coming out that's got better effects and, you know, more modern. But I really think that Star Trek, above other films and TV shows, kind of stands the test of time a little better. And especially that movie, I mean, essentially it is just an action movie. So, I mean, you know, it'll always have that. But, you know, it definitely needed more staff meetings.
All right. How about you, Drew?
Well, like Greg said, it's a great introduction to Next Generation, but the more episodes of Next Generation that I watch, the lower... I mean, it's still my favorite Next Generation movie, low bar, but I like watching it this time, I was watching it and I was thinking to myself, why do I like this movie so much again? I mean, there's just, I'm just randomly watching Next Generation episodes, and each one that I watch just makes me like Next Generation more, but the movies, all of them, less. Which I guess is good for, you know, I've got, what, 200 episodes of Next Generation versus four movies.
So. Interesting.
Right.
It's good for me.
How about you, Brian?
It's good for you. It's good for me. Like I said in the beginning, it's the same opinion. I mean, it's and what you guys said too. It's my favorite, but it's a low bar. It's a solid film. It's a very good film. It's not a great Star Trek film, but it's got a lot of good stuff to it. I don't think it comes together into a, you know, one magnificent whole the way something like Wrath of Khan does or Voyage Home does. But it's got a lot of good stuff to it.
Yeah. Great. All right. Well, it's been fun talking about First Contact, and there's so many elements to talk about. So we hit on a few of them, and maybe in the future we'll return to it and hit on some of the other ones. But I'm glad you all could join us today. So before we go, Brian, why don't you tell everyone where they can find you around the internet?
Sure. Well, I'm Greg mentioned, I'm a co-host on a podcast called Down in Front, where we started life recording our own alternate commentaries to movies, and we have over 100 of those. And we've recently switched format, so we're more of a traditional free-flowing conversation style podcast, which we're doing now. But you can catch us there at downinfront.net. It's also on Twitter at downinfront. You can find me on Twitter at Brian Finifter, BRIANFINIFTER. And then on Facebook, and my email is also exists, and I live in Los Angeles, so just wave.
Everything you need to know about Brian. All right.
So just come to the Valley and wave, and I'll find you.
Excellent. All right. Thanks for joining us today, Brian.
No problem, guys. Have a good night.
Thanks, Brian.
I'm going to run.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Mike, tell everyone where they can find you. Of course, everyone knows your music.
Well, yeah, obviously I'm in 5-Year Mission, so you can find links to just about anything at 5yearmission.net. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, and all of our music on iTunes and things like that. If you are interested in seeing us in person, we will be at the Chicago Con this year, opening for all 5 Star Trek captains.
Okay, that sounds excellent. And we're really looking forward, Mike, to the Tribble EP when that comes out. And hopefully you're 3 sometime soon, I hope. Maybe is it going to be next year?
Yeah, the Tribble EP is coming out very soon. We're in the process of recording it now. Then we will work on year 3 after that, which will probably come out at this point, probably mid-2013.
All right. Well, we'll be anxiously awaiting that. And in the meantime, you might have a guest appearance by Greg, because Greg is working on his... What was that you were working on, Greg? Was that the Ballad of the Borg Drone before we started recording today?
Yes. Yes, the Ballad of the Borg Drone. It's coming. It's coming along. I've got a couple chords to figure out, a couple slant rhymes that aren't quite working, but yeah, no. That'll be coming on an upcoming EP very soon.
Looking forward to that. All right, great. Thanks, Mike. And Drew, tell everyone where they can find you around the internets.
They can find me at Twitter. I'm at 005, DOUBLEOFIVE. When I feel the need to write about movies, my new movie home is cinetropolis.net, CINETROPOLIS.net. I was invited to write for them, so that's exciting for me. And I also run the social media for Star Wars Revisited, the fan edit by 81. And I have to say that Empire is shaping up to look really good. And it's definitely something to look forward to this year.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to that. Great. Well, we'll have links in the show notes to the sites and the Twitter accounts and all, so we can make sure everyone can get over there. Great. Well, Mike and Drew, thanks for joining us today. It was great to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
No problem.
Well, that was one of the most interesting episodes of The Brady Bunch that I have ever seen.
It was. I just loved having the five boxes on the screen. And I loved the way that we were able to look at each other at angles, you know, up and down as we discussed First Contact.
Yes. It was very good. Now, I kept looking back at our show page. I kept thinking, we must have done First Contact. We must have. But no, this is the only next-gen movie we hadn't done. And then we have done Best of Both Worlds. Don't know if we've done Scorpion yet, but we did a show like about the Borg in general.
Yeah, we did do Scorpion.
And we did Scorpion. Yeah. So we've talked about the Borg so much, but actually getting to do First Contact, mm-hmm. this is the first time. And I think we finally had a really good discussion, especially like talking about the Enterprise itself and the story as it developed to get here. And I don't know. I think it came across negative tonight, and I really wish I hadn't come across so negative, because I do enjoy this film. I watch it more than probably any of the other Star Trek films. So please don't take away from this that I don't like it. It's just this time it kind of struck me as a little less substantial than the TNG episodes I've been watching.
Well, I think, not only have we talked about the Borg a lot, we even did Regeneration, which is in a way a sequel to this movie. Yep. From Enterprise. But now I think the thing is, I hope people didn't take it too much as negative, because actually, like I said at the end, I mean, this and The Wrath of Khan are, for me, the two best of all the Star Trek movies. I think that the deal with First Contact is that at the time that it came out, it was such a good movie, and it felt like the next generation had truly come into its own. You know, the ship design, the costume design, the actors, you know, the actors were their characters by that point. There's, the Borg looked amazing compared to what we had seen on television. And it felt like a movie, whereas Generations didn't always feel like a movie. I think that the way we received First Contact when it first came out was such a strong impression that it's really hard for any film to stand the test of time like that. And so, and this movie, I mean, let's not forget this movie. It came out in 1996. So what are we talking about? 16 years ago now?
Oh,
me
wow.
and my brilliant math
That's
skills.
That's crazy.
It's hard. And as we look back at it now, and we've watched it dozens and dozens and dozens of times over the year.
Yeah.
Anytime you watch something that many times, you start to notice all the little tiny things in it that maybe you feel could have been done differently. So I think that's all it is. But it's no doubt that it's still a great movie.
Yeah, I imagine if I watched Frame of Mind over and over and over again, I would find faults in it as well. Mm-hmm. And that's probably part of it.
Yeah.
It's so much easier to just watch an episode and think that was great. And then another one, and that was great. And soon I've watched, you know, 20 hours of really fantastic Star Trek and, you know, 3 hours of subpar Star Trek and an hour of horrible Star Trek. But overall, sitting down to watch TNG, I get a great impression. Whereas, as you say, with First Contact, I've seen it so many times, I'm starting to nitpick bits and pieces.
I mean, you reach a point where you know all the lines. I mean, you've memorized everything in the movie. And so then at that point, when you're watching it, you are looking for every, you know, a tiny little thing. And but it's I think it was the pinnacle of TNG.
Yep.
It was probably this movie. This, you know, In All Good Things towards the end. And, of course, midway through Best of Both Worlds, you know, was kind of a peak.
Yeah,
as well.
Well, this is kind of the peak of Star Wars, of Star Trek, I should say, because you have a really good movie and you have two series on the air, and at least DS9 was firing on all cylinders at this point. Voyager was still kind of finding its way, but Star Trek has not gotten back here yet.
Yeah, and I don't know if it ever will. I mean, that was truly in the middle of the Golden Age, but.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's tell people where they can find us if they want to share their thoughts on First Contact or anything else we talked about today. You can go to trek.fm/contact and send us a text message through there. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm and on Google+ at hyperchannel/trekfmg+. And of course, you can find us on Twitter at username trekfm. And that's where we're always talking about Star Trek. And Greg, also, I should mention, I almost forget to do this. We recently, just this past week, we implemented a new discussion system on the TrekFM site using Discuss. And I don't know how many people are familiar with that. It's actually very widely used on lots and lots of huge websites all over the internet. You can log in both through a Discuss account or you can use an OpenID. There are many, many ways you can log in. And you can also set to get email notifications when your threads are commented on. It's something that we didn't have the capability of in the past on our site. And so I really encourage everyone to go and take advantage of that. And, you know, let us know what you think about what we talk about in our articles, in our podcasts, and so forth. You'll just find it at the bottom of every page. If you're not logged in, it'll ask you to log in or create an account with Discuss. So I hope you enjoy that. And going back to Twitter, of course, Greg, everyone can also find you on Twitter.
Yes, that's right. I am there at Greg Harbin. And as I was talking with Drew Stewart before the show, most of my Twitter feed over the past few days has been about the fact that I went back to season one, Greg, and I shaved the beard, which has been a great shock to all of my friends and family and my Twitter people. And I don't know. I probably need to stop talking about it at some point, but if you're going to follow me right now, be prepared.
Yeah.
Be prepared for the beard or the lack thereof.
The lack thereof. I was shocked. I mean, when I turned on the cameras today to do the show, right. I wasn't sure I was going to be able to continue because I'm like, Greg, you know, we just did our 50th show. Are we going back to the first show again? What's going on? That's what I'm doing.
Yeah. Yes.
So
we're going to have to do all of this over again, basically.
Right. This has all happened before, and it'll all happen again.
So say we all.
So around September, maybe you'll grow the beard again, right? There'll be three months from
probably
now.
Probably something like that.
Yeah. All right. All right. Well, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. And if you follow me, give me a shout. Send me an @ reply. I love talking to everyone. I may not tweet a whole lot on my own these days, but I definitely do enjoy chatting about Treks or anything else. So just let me know you followed me. All right, Greg. Well, if you like the show, please drop by iTunes, leave us a rating, leave us a review. We still haven't been we hear from so many people on Twitter who are listening to the show and send us emails and all kinds of stuff, but yet we don't get very much feedback on iTunes. So it does help people find the show. So if you'd like and you haven't done it yet, drop by and leave us a rating and a review on there as well. All right, Greg, well, I'm going to run. I've got to go break my little ships.
All right, Chris, I think it's time to stick some chronoton particles in it because the ready room is done.
There we go. All right. Are you ready?
Yes, I am now recording.
And we're set.